So you might think that, who knows what you might think about being ordained? Who knows what these guys think? Does it mean that somebody is like accomplished in some way or knows something? Norman's suggestion to priests, three practices he suggests are, number one, be humble. Number two, try to help. And number three, see everyone as Buddha. Be humble, try to help, see everyone as Buddha. Those are good practices for anybody. So, you know, again, like, what's the difference? Yeah, we should all practice that way, right? We know how it works out if we're not humble. We know how it works out if we don't try to help, right? We know how it works out if we see other people as, like, you know, the opposite of Buddha. However that works out for you. So it seems to be that ordaining as a priest is a statement of commitment and of public practice, that you can't, you know, you can't get out of it ever again. And those of you who started sewing rakasu for our lay precept ceremony, some they used to call it lay ordination, which is oxymoronic already, but our system kind of has that built in, so it's probably a good oxymoron, lay ordination, to receive the precepts formally and the little bib-like thing like some of these guys are wearing. So we have several people preparing for that, six people. And so those of you will be happy to know that Chris knows a lot about sewing, so there's another resource. I'll try to figure out how to get that done between now and our ceremony, which we hope will be in October. So we have some ordinations coming up. And so tonight so ordinations are always about precepts. The priest ordination includes the exact same precepts as the lay ordination, the Jukai ordination. And tonight we're finishing our two months, series of talks and ceremonies about the Zen precepts. The Zen ethical guidelines. And the other talks are all online, so if you missed any, you can listen, or in the cases where they really had written out their notes, if we tried to put their notes, you can read, but not everybody did that. And we heard from every one of the people in our Sangha who are empowered to give talks, so that's pretty wonderful. If you can recall that far back in time, Talis gave a talk about killing and stealing, or refraining from killing and stealing. Nancy gave a talk about the three different grave precepts that connect to our speech and communication. Edie gave a talk about working with anger. John gave a talk about intoxication and working with our addictive, you know, tendencies. And Bob gave a talk about three treasures, which is sort of the beginning and the ending of the 16 precepts, and I'll give you a handout later if you don't know this list. The beginning and the ending reconnect with this sort of archetypal triple treasure, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So Bob Penny spoke about that. Bob is home tonight with his dying cat, and Nancy is home tonight with her inflamed joints. So that's where they are, if you're wondering. And so I was thinking about, well, what are the precepts and how would we practice with them? It seems like the root of precepts practice is a real inquiry into how it actually goes for us. How do things work out? What happens in our life? Looking into patterns, triggers, habits, looking at what happens when we meet the world, which is always happening, moment after moment. So precepts practice is maybe a kind of a feeling into connections. Some connections are simple, some are complex. All of these connections are fluid and changing. Suzuki Roshi said, it's not always so. Everything's always a little different than we think. And so mindfulness practice, in its basic root form as remembering, is a key, seems to be a key ingredient to practicing with the precepts as investigation, as a way to learn. To develop the quality of mind that can remember. This possibility of actually like sort of snapping out of the dream once in a while. Looking at what we're hooked on and seeing it in a little different way and remembering, oh yeah, here I am, you know, here it is. Remembering that there's always a process unfolding. A process, you know, of rich, interconnected causes that lead to all kinds of conditions. Investigating how these causes weave together and create a pattern of experience that we call me. Remembering to see the way we hold ourselves as a fixed being. Me, mine, personality, what I like, what I don't like, what I am, who I'm not, and the way we take our experience so personally. Everyone around us should be paying attention to me. And they should act in the ways that I like. And if they don't, I have to do something about it. Internal or external. So maybe precepts help us by kind of holding up some different mirrors. A mirror in front of how we speak. Oh, look, how am I speaking? A mirror in front of our generosity and our stinginess. A mirror in front of our sexuality. How do we act and what is that reflecting? What is that reflecting? Inside us, in our process, what are we? Who are we? Precepts practice isn't just a kind of straightening up or cleaning up our conduct. It's a looking inside, it seems, a deep kind of investigation. So these teachings of the precepts are not a way to just sort of find all our flaws. Because what are our flaws? They must be flaws in our fixed identity. So precepts are not a way to just push us into trying harder, being better people. They're an encouragement to forget about being a person, to soften around this radical oversimplification we do whenever we identify ourselves as anything or with anything. To open again and again and again to the rich possibilities of our bigger life, a bigger self than just this habit of me. To see if we can see the gaps, you know, in this little prison that we can so easily make of me. But yet, seeing the precepts of practice instead of only as rules is not a free pass. It doesn't mean I can do whatever I want because I'm investigating the delusion of me. Precepts are about responsibility. But actually they go even deeper than rules. It's a fuller responsibility than following rules because it's taking responsibility for our own mind, not just what comes out of our mouth that somebody else can notice or how we move our body. So taking responsibility for how we understand our own life. While we can't control our life, we can take responsibility for our effort to study and understand. So it seems like to do this practice of investigating skillfully with some freedom, you know, so we're not just tying ourselves up in knots, like, oh my God, you know. Terrible. I have to understand every thought now, you know. Ugh, you know. We need to bring some qualities to play. Some curiosity, some interest, some playfulness. And the great thing is that if we can soften around the idea that it's me, I'm that kind of person, we get some fluidity. We get some new angles. And so the invitation of this practice is to be willing to be with everything. To notice the thoughts that arise moment by moment, even the fleeting ones, gone, you know, in an instant. Not just the ones that stick and twist us up in knots. You know, you can't help but notice those, right? And as you notice the thoughts and emotions and impulses that pass through mind, so many are negative. Have you noticed this? So many are a little difficult. So many are a little threatening to some idea we might have about what kind of person we are or are supposed to be. The judgmental thought. The angry thought. To notice that we want to drown them out with our narrative chatter or to distract ourselves with entertainment and distractions to stay busy. It seems that you folks are willing to experiment with not doing that so much. I don't know why else you'd be sitting around here. To actually invite forward the states of mind that come and go with equanimity, to learn how not to be destabilized by the things we don't like and how not to be destabilized by the things that we do like. To turn towards everything and see it as best we can as it is, not adding or taking away. And what's great about this is it's not always so fun. We don't always like what we see. From our point of view of being the me we want to be, it's a little bit difficult to see all these judgmental thoughts or whatever it is. But the good thing is that if we can allow ourselves to really turn towards this process, we start to notice also the gaps between the thoughts, that the thoughts don't stick around, that they change, that they vanish again, something new arises. We can soften around these patterns and habits of mind so radically that they don't have so much hold on us. Just an angry thought. That's all it is. And this is really powerful. This is a great gift for us and a gift for the world. And we would never learn this unless we were willing to turn towards our experience this fully, this radically. If we're always sort of pulling away and not looking, we can't see the insubstantiality of these things, the softness, the spaciousness of them. We could never see otherwise that what seems to be the opposite is in the middle. Like we had a great teaching from the weather. Did you notice while we were sitting it was sunny and raining at the same time? So this is the nature of our life. It's not this or that. It's this and that. Sunny and rainy. Angry and tight and beautiful and generous at the same time. In the middle of even the hottest, tightest of anger, there seems to be also peacefulness, spaciousness, right there. So to be ourself fully in our experience is to feel all of this and to feel the way that it can coexist. Which one is the real me, if any, if all? As Dogen put it, to study the self is to forget the self. Or maybe that means to just be with everything that's unfolding. But sometimes these teachings of non-self can also confuse us. There's a balance here. It's not all, the goal is not just to be like, just being, you know. We're people in the middle of the soup. We're in the action. We have to make choices. We have to respond, sometimes very quickly. Sometimes not as quickly as we think, but often we have to respond. And sometimes we need a little willpower. We need to actually just show up. We need to make a choice. Maybe we're ready. Maybe we can do more than we thought. Maybe we're stronger than we thought. Maybe we can make a huge effort to wake up, but maybe that effort can be a little more free. Maybe it can be a great effort without strain, without tension, but effort nonetheless. So there does seem to be a me operating in the middle of this non-me-ness. Other times, the practice of non-self can be so freeing if we can remember that it is available to us. To recognize anger is arising is so much more spacious and free than something like, "It pisses me off when you do that." We can train our mind to see anger, thought as thought, emotion as emotion. We can remember, here's mindfulness training again. We can remember to turn towards all that arises with patience and curiosity. And when we seem to violate a precept, we can wonder, now why did that happen? That's interesting. Oh, and then more thoughts arise around that. We can wonder about causes and conditions. The Buddha was very explicit about this. Not to think that we really know this always happens or that always happens, to wind back the clock a little bit in our mind, to wonder what choices did we make yesterday and the day before and the year before, what influences came into our life that nudged us in one direction or another, and can we have some choice and some ability to make a change in some of the causes and conditions that came into that moment where we acted in that way. Maybe as an example, who we're choosing to associate with. Maybe it's better not to spend so much time with that person anymore, because one thing leads to another. When did I take that fork in the road? Maybe I can remember next time. And so we can train our mind and our heart. And remember the Chinese character that we pronounce Xin in our sutras means mind and heart together. So in the Heart Sutra, that's the character, mind and heart. So we could say the Mind Sutra, the Great Mind Beyond Mind Sutra, or the Great Heart Beyond Heart Sutra. So we can train the heart-mind and the mind-heart, and we need them both. One way to look at the 10 specific precepts on killing and lying and intoxicants and speech and so on are that they're a kind of a spelling out of the 3 pure precepts. So we have 2 sets of 3 and then a set of 10. So the second set of 3, the 3 pure precepts, are explicated and explained by the 10. And the wording for the 3 pure precepts I like best is the first one I learned, I think probably, I don't know if it was Norman or a sort of standard Zen Center wording at the time, but those 3 are: do all action that increases awareness, number 1. Do everything that increases awareness. Number 2, refrain from action that increases suffering. Number 3, live for and with all beings. So I like this translation. Do what increases awareness, refrain from that which increases suffering, live for and with all beings. And how are you going to find out what increases awareness and suffering? By reading lots of books or something? No. By experimenting, right? By experimenting. Ouch, you know. That increased suffering. Ah, that increased awareness, right? I feel connected to all beings, I feel divorced from all beings. So we find out, you know, through trial and error. So I like this translation, but it turns out to be a pretty big rewrite. So religion goes this way. The first precept is a little bit confusing in Chinese. It seems to mean more or less hold all precepts with restraint precept. Something like that. Hold all precepts with restraint precept. So the first pure precept seems to originally mean something like practice the precepts. The precept that says practice the precepts. In Reb Anderson's book, Being Upright, he has a whole discussion about this. I couldn't find my copy, but you can read it. And he translates this precept as something like embrace and sustain regulation and ceremony. Sounds very like, okay, so you got to be a good Buddhist or something. Embrace and sustain regulation and ceremony is a little confusing. So somehow we can turn that into increasing awareness, which makes sense in a way, you know, that all the precepts are designed to increase awareness. So it's interesting, you know, the more you learn about any tradition, the more complicated and sort of rewritten and fiddled with it turns out to be. It's okay. We're all inventing our life all the time, right, including our practice. And the second pure precept does seem to just mean do good, do good. And the third does seem to mean something like include all beings in precept practice. So I looked all this up today because I thought, oh, it's probably something really simple like do good, no evil, you know, something like that, but it's more complicated. Oh well. Anyway, this whole topic of precepts and conduct is known collectively as sila or shila in Sanskrit and Pali in the early Buddhist languages. And they had, there's so many lists, you know, what the key ingredients of practice are. And one of the best lists, or I want to bring up a great list of three, which is that there are three ingredients to a healthy practice and therefore a healthy life. This shila or sila, the precept practice, and then samadhi, and then prajna. So you heard the word prajna a little while ago, we chanted that word. And samadhi we've talked about before. So precepts, and then samadhi means concentration or clarity, awareness, clear awareness or concentrated awareness. So doing what we need to do so the mind is a little more clear, a little more at rest, a little more aware of what's happening. Which makes sense, right? If the mind was just 100% agitated and freaked out, how could the precepts include this kind of inner work that we're talking about? So precepts, stable, concentrated mind. And then prajna is translated as wisdom. But wisdom in Buddhism doesn't mean like knowing a lot of stuff. So now we're back to priests. Priests don't necessarily know a lot of stuff, but they're committed to practicing with prajna. Prajna means something more like insight or reflection or discernment. So it's more of a process word and less of a knowledge word. The ability to discern. This leads to suffering. This leads to awakening. This leads to awareness. So maybe you could translate for all, translation of all of this is something like practice precepts, clear awareness, and wise seeing. Precepts, clear awareness, and wise seeing. So we need all these things together. So this practice, this willing to investigate things as they are, and as this is reflected in our conduct of body, speech, and mind, is such a rich, you know, challenging, joyous thing. And it's hard, too. There are times we really don't want to deal with it. We want to goof off. We want to distract ourselves. And maybe that's okay. Maybe we are at a point where we need to take a rest, take another run at it later. But then the key thing here is back to mindfulness, to remember, oh, that's what I'm doing. I'm goofing off right now, okay? To goof off with awareness is a whole different thing, right? Goofing off without awareness, we twist into all kinds of justifications, right? Oh, this practice is no good anyway, right? Maybe it's just we don't want to deal with it right now. We want to choose to goof off. And when we're choosing not to face our experience, to know that we're choosing not to face our experience, that's wisdom, right? That's discernment. So the practice of not practicing is practice. If we know that that's what we're doing. If we don't know what that's what we're doing, that's delusion. That's suffering. So this takes a lot of humility. We're going to do it wrong a lot. If we're willing to really stir things up and look at our confused, conditioned existence. We'll make mistakes, we'll offend people, we'll misstep, we'll take the wrong road, but how will we ever find the right road if we don't venture pretty far down the wrong road? We have to feel it, right? Because each of us has our own road, our own path to follow. That's why they call it the Great Way, you know, because it includes infinite number of paths and they're all the right path. And in the end, you know, whether we like it or not, sooner or later, we will have to soften around this me. Hopefully, you know, with some support and some joy and some possibility of living with a little freedom for the rest of our days, maybe if we're not so lucky on our deathbed. But sooner or later, we'll have to. And how can we soften if we don't let it learn to be okay with being wrong? And learn to be okay with being right and see how limited that is anyway. And learn that there's no one in the middle of all this who's right or wrong anyway. And we have to be able to forgive ourselves. And forgive others. So, these are my suggestions about practicing the precepts. It's an outer work and an inner work. And then instead of seeing the precepts and the many ways that we inevitably will violate the precepts as missteps or screw-ups or failures, we can see them as clues, as signposts, as encouragement. Encouragement to investigate, to keep going, take another run at it. And when things seem to go right, and there does seem to be harmony and joy and an absence of suffering, such a loss to just kind of go, whew. No, to be awake then too, like, well, this is interesting. There's an absence of suffering right now. Wonder why that would be. Wonder what's going on. To be present through thick and thin. And to do any of this, we have to just keep remembering, right? So here's a little koan about remembering. A Zen story about this effort, you know, moment by moment effort of calling to ourselves to remember. Every day, Master Zwigon used to call to himself, Master! And he would answer himself, Yes? And he would tell himself, Be awake! Be awake! And he would answer himself, Yes! Yes! And he would remind himself again, Don't be deceived, day or night. And he would say to himself, No! No! You could actually do this practice, actually. You know, a little maybe less, you know. But you can call to yourself, you know. Tim? Yes? You know, just call to yourself and respond. Because we get so caught, right? You know, it's like, you know, the way that days can kind of start out okay and then progressively just, you know, this, you know, it's more and more stress. Why is that? Is that baked into the day? No, it's because we don't call to ourselves, you know. Tim, all right. Here I am. And another way we can practice with this is practice of phrases is very powerful. So I want to give you a practice. If you can take it on if you like. Practice of chanting and the practice of phrases is helpful because the things that we chant over and over and over again, so repetition is key here, over and over again, they kind of get into our consciousness in a certain way. that's available to our subconscious, and occasionally our subconscious will kind of call to us in the same way as the story here. And we go, oh, where did that come from? Sometimes a little phrase from something we chant or recite over and over again will come to us. So I have a little precepts thing you can chant every day if you want. Actually, I need to give you a few more. Helps, give me one. So if some of you maybe have given this to you before, there'll be enough for everyone if you didn't get one of some more somewhere. So if you want to, you could add a practice to your daily practice, if you have a daily practice, and if you don't, here's one. It takes about 2 minutes, so you can't really tell yourself, I don't have time, if you want to take this on. I wrote it for morning practice, because that's when I usually do daily practice, so you could rewrite it any way you wanted. So just to say this to yourself, out loud is best. Open, you can be like this. And there's a blank there, and in that blank, you could put in your name. And if you receive the precepts, you get a Dharma name, so you could put your Dharma name if you want, or you could put your English name. You could just skip that part, if that seems a little, you know, self-conscious, like, I don't know. I don't want my identity in this. Yet. But, you know, I mean, it's good to have your name in there. So, O Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, please concentrate your hearts on me. So let's do it together. O Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, please concentrate your hearts on me. I, Noman Doan, Buddha's disciple, greet the new day with humility and joy. May I today, in all actions of body, speech, and mind, affirm life, give generously, keep the mind clear, treasure the body, be courageous and kind in speech, open to and heal through strong emotions, and return to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha on every breath. Thank you very much.